This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. And as usual, I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Hey, Chris, how are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. And this week we have a returning guest, Aaron Brown from Infinidat. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back again.
Really looking forward to it. What is this now, number three, I think you've been on?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, excellent. So you're an expert. You know exactly how we do it. No problems there.
I hope so.
Good. Okay, we wanted to today to spend some time talking about ransomware and processes for actually solving or at least avoiding ransomware. And in particular, because we're going to talk about your products today and explore what Infinidat is doing to help customers solve that problem, we're going to talk a bit more in detail about what we're seeing out there and how your products and solutions are fixing that problem. So why don't we start with the subject of ransomware in the first place and just try and level set everybody about where we are and how ransomware has developed. Aaron, do you want to pick that one up?
Sure, thank you. So unless you've been stuck under a rock for the last couple of years, you already know what ransomware is and how attackers will try to get you to pay them for unlocking your data. And what has really changed in the last couple of years is the type of attacks that we're seeing, whether it's state-sponsored attacks to make money for unnamed states. We won't try to implicate anybody today. Coordinated wide-scale attacks, multi-vector attacks, etc. But also the change of attackers to much more sophisticated approaches, starting from trying to silently encrypt the data very slowly in the background or to only encrypt subsets of the data so they remain undetected, attacking service providers instead of end users so that they can have a wider impact and get more people to pay them to unlock their data. So multiple things are happening in that arena, and the whole cybersecurity arena as a whole is very interesting right now. But for enterprises that rely more and more on their data to drive their business, that is definitely an interesting threat to keep close watch of.
Absolutely. Martin, from your perspective as an actual user, what's your view? Have you looked at it and thought there is an increasing level of sophistication that you need to be even more aware of?
Yep, definitely is increasing the threat levels, the amount of attacks we're seeing and the amount of things which are appearing out in the wild. We've also got things, I mean, we're expecting a big increase in January as things like Windows 2007 and 8 drop out of support and people stop paying for their security patches from Microsoft. So there's all these things. It seems to be a bit of a perfect storm for ransomware at the moment.
And people seem, this Aaron just mentioned there, targeting the backup system so that you destroy or damage the backups so that when you do corrupt the primary data, that backup data is not there to do the restore.
Yeah, backup systems are often a weak link. Because of its sheer nature, it's a good place where obviously you've got all the backup data, which that's obvious. But also backup systems often have access to every other system in your environment. And so if they're not well secured, they're a great thing to attack.
Absolutely. So let's go back and talk about the impact again, because I think we sort of touched on it very briefly there, Aaron, about the wide impact. But ultimately, we've said this many, many times, the world expects you to be selling and delivering your products 24 hours a day. And if you're not doing that, that's a massive issue for businesses.
I couldn't agree more. And there's one particular study that I think really kind of demonstrates that with one figure. Google ran a study to understand how quickly users abandon websites if they take long time to load. And they, of course, monitor many websites across the web and through Google Chrome. And especially for mobile users, which are the vast majority of users, it only takes 3 seconds for more than half of your users to abandon the website. That, I think, signifies more than anything that instant gratification, I want to have everything immediately kind of society or consumer society we live in. And that sets a new bar for businesses in how they plan their infrastructure and the amount of money they lose when that infrastructure fails to support them.
Yeah, I remember looking at something a few years ago, and it was in conjunction with IBM. They were looking at how they could speed up the data they were collecting from websites, and they were looking at a huge level of sophistication at the way that people click through a website, or the way that they followed a path through, or their reaction to web pages not loading fast enough, or whatever it happened to be. So without a doubt, we have incredibly sophisticated users using any application, whether that's a web page or whether that's a mobile app, very, very sophisticated.
I think you just gave one of the best examples of what digital transformation really is. It's if everything's happening digitally, everything can be tracked and measured and analyzed for constant improvement. But then again, we come back to that increased level of reliance on the data and the infrastructure that runs that data. And that has become a business imperative to be able to recover from all sorts of failures. Last time I was here, we spoke about how do you handle things as large as a site level failure and kind of geoclustering, but logical failures are not any different.
I find his abandonment figure rather interesting because I think as I watch the way my daughter, who's 18, the way she surfs and those things, yeah, she will abandon a website, but they do go back. So sometimes I wonder if we over-egg the losses. But I think it's generally a good point. But I do think that people do go back. They say, okay, Amazon today is not loading or something else. So they go and look at something else, but they come back again. So I think we have to be very careful when we're quoting some of these statistics.
I would agree with that, but I would add a little caveat to it. And I think that is, if you're Amazon or if you're Google, people have a certain tolerance to put up with that. If you're a website where you're looking for, let's think, I don't know, you're searching for a holiday or you're looking for some other piece of information, if you don't find it on that website and you know that you could look on the second or third option on the Google search, you'll go back to that.
That's fair enough.
I agree with you that, but I think, you know, some people are a special case and other ones probably more generically. And I think that sort of goes back to Aaron's point.
Oh, no, I would only add that many websites today, many businesses today pay for AdWords or other forms of advertising to get people to the website. So it's not just the cost of the business that you've lost. You've also created, you've paid for the impression, you got the click. So you've already made that payment, but then you didn't get the revenue behind it. So it kind of changes the whole economics of advertising to get people in, plus the reputation component of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, let's move on and talk about ransomware. And I think we could talk about ransomware in general, but also I think ransomware is part of, I guess, a bigger set of problems that a company might have in terms of their data being corrupted. You know, you might have the malicious corruption of data through ransomware, for example, but you also might have data corruption for other reasons. And there might be other reasons why you might want to restore some or all of your environment in that scenario, especially if we're talking about centralized storage here. Now, in terms of a toolkit, I think everybody immediately assumes that we'll do restore from things like ransomware by going to backups. And that seems to be a sort of single dimension, one dimensional type idea. And I don't think it's as simple as that. What do you think, Aaron?
I have to agree. I think we have to assume different types of failures and build proper recovery mechanisms for each of them. So physical failures have their own redundancies. Logical failures have separate redundancies. Within the world of logical failures, you have an IT admin that is accidentally doing the wrong thing at the wrong time and may have been wise enough to take a snapshot before he started just in case something goes sideways and can quickly recover from that. And then you have ransomware that was kind of lying dormant for 6 weeks to 6 months and created a lot of changes in your data. So it really requires a different set of tools, whether they're quick recoveries from a small change or a small time gap, whether they are large recoveries, for example, ransomware that's been dormant for a couple of months. And it goes back to a couple of questions like, how quickly do I need to recover? What's the cost of not being available to my customers? How much data will I have to move around as part of that recovery? And statistically speaking, the longer you recover, the longer time period you recover from, of course, the more data you have to move around. This is why snapshots are so efficient, because they act as a very efficient first line of defense, allowing you to recover from short periods of time, let's say within weeks kind of period, but without moving any data. And that usually tackles a lot of your recovery scenarios. But then when you're talking about ransomware, yeah, this will usually be something that you take out of a backup scenario.
I find it really interesting when we look at that, though, because I'm trying to think if I've ever really had to spend time recovering an entire environment. I don't know about you, Martin, but if ever I've done anything, I've recovered individual servers, one or two servers, but no, I've never had to go back to my entire server farm or VM farm and say, let's recover 100 servers or 200 servers. And it seems to me that when you look at the time it takes for people to recover from ransomware, reliance on backup means that they do take forever to get back.
Yeah, I've never seen it done. I've never been involved in a site recovery, which has involved recovering hundreds of servers. Worst case, we've recovered a couple of databases, but I've never seen something quite as catastrophic. I really hope I never do, to be honest, because I'm not quite sure how you go about it. Certainly where you've got consistency in trying to work out how you recover 200 servers into a known state so everything's consistent with each other.
There's the key bit. You know, if you're recovering stuff, actually, there's such a huge number of interdependencies, it's not going to be that straightforward. Now, as an example, in the larger environments that I worked in, we wouldn't have relied on any sort of backup or restore from the backup system. We would have relied on having replication, and if we didn't have replication, we would have at least snapshots. So we would have relied on centralized storage to do that simply because of the SLA we were trying to deliver. And I think that's what you're saying, Aaron, isn't it? That by having that mixture of other technologies, you can actually address the SLAs of getting the business back up in different ways.
Exactly. Different failure scenarios, different recovery mechanisms. And to Martin's point about never having to restore an entire farm, I agree with you. I think that's usually more of a physical failure scenario, like your data center was flooded or lost power and you moved over to the DR. That's not a logical corruption scenario, at least not commonly. What is common, I think, from the logical perspective is, again, the ransomware example is a perfect one. It was dormant. It was lying around for weeks or months. And then the aggregated change over those 6 months can be quite substantial to move around using traditional backup solutions that are not snapshots.
Yeah, agreed. So let's kind of talk about your products, Aaron, what Infinidata's got and what you're doing. Now, we talked about some of this the last time you were on the podcast. Do you want to go back and sort of just remind us, and then we can see where you've moved on since then?
So usually when I came on the podcast, most of our discussions were around our primary tier one storage offering. And here we're focusing on a separate product, which is called InfiniGuard. And InfiniGuard looks at a very specific problem. As you send your backups into your backups target, you try to minimize the cost of backups. You use the cheapest, highest density media possible, and then you add deduplication and compression and all other types of synthetic full backups to that to accelerate your backup cycles. However, that creates the obvious problem on the recovery side, because if my backups are deduplicated, it means my data is kind of spread around my backup target in a very fragmented way, essentially. Now, we use the cheapest media, which is spinning drives, to store all of our backups. So these drives were never designed to perform highly random IOs. You need some software above them to provide that layer of efficiency that can drive that performance. Because while backup stream hours are highly sequential, recovery streams are actually not exactly sequential, because I'm recovering some of my backups from last week and some of my backups from 5 days ago and some of my backup from 4 or 3 in 2 days ago. So I have to kind of, we call that rehydrate all of these backups into one coherent and consistent copy. And that can actually trigger a lot of very random IO on the back end. And that's what slows down recoveries. And you talk to anybody who's run large scale backup scenarios, and they will say that their backup speed could be as high as 10 times compared to their recovery speed. And I always joke that nobody ever called their IT department and said, hey, you know, nothing broke today. Thanks, guys. Keep up the good work. IT is always measured at times of crisis. So nobody cares if all the backups are successful if it takes you too long to recover.
So the interesting thing there, though, let me add a little bit of little flavor to that. So obviously, when we first started to get deduplicating appliances, and I didn't really use too many of them in my career, but when we started getting those, as you said, the ingestion of data was a lot more efficient than the recovery of data from those platforms. And the challenge being, because you deduplication by its very nature causes the data to be more randomized across the whole content of what you have. Obviously, recovering a single image, shall we say, which could have scatterings of components from various different backup times and so on, means your recovery is going to be random. Now, what's your opinion, Martin? I never saw a lot of these products in use, but I do know that another IBM example, that they ended up putting all flash underneath their products simply because that was the only way they could get the performance on restore.
Yeah, so I've never really used them in anger, but I can see why. Actually, I think it was an interesting point. I mean, people always talk about a backup environment, and if you talk to anybody who's worked in backup for long enough, we should be talking about recovery environment. Too often the focus is on is actually how quickly you can back the data up, whereas it should really be how quickly can you recover that data. And because the nature of the workloads are very different, a recovery workload can be very random. We should be focusing more on that, and I would like to see the backup vendors, for instance, pay more attention to the recovery options.
Yeah, so let's go back and talk about InfiniGuard in a bit more detail, Aaron. As I think about this in a bit more detail, the first thing that springs to mind is, I know in your primary products that you had a locality of data and a data reference locality technique that you used for knowing where to place data as it was being stored, so that when it was accessed again, you would effectively convert what would have been a random request into more sequential. And that was one of the ways that you managed to improve the performance of building a disk system. Is this using similar technology?
Exactly. So at the back end of every InfiniGuard, our secondary storage, lies an Infinibox. It's the same underlying architecture. And that temporal location and understanding that backup streams that came in together are very likely to be recovered together, enabling things like predictive caching and things like that, that accelerate the recovery speed a lot more than traditional, just a bunch of disks behind some deduped array. That really sets the gap between them. Go back to what Martin said. One of the most commonly untested scenarios during POCs, for example, is let's run a synthetic full backup over 14 or 20 generations and then test the recovery speed. People usually try to cram these POCs into a week, and then they can only manage a recovery from 2, 3, 5 generations. So they kind of limit the amount of fragmentation, et cetera, of their backup. And as a result, they have a very different experience during the POC as opposed to the real life deployment. And that leads to a lot of frustration. I highly recommend customers really extend those POCs, take a non-critical environment because this is not your backup solution yet, and back it up for a whole month. Incremental synthetic full backups, and then see what your recovery looks like. And that will tell you the difference between a simple data layout on low-cost drives and an intelligent data layout that does account for things like temporal locality.
I think that's a classic example of needing to think through the requirements of a POC, Martin, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine the number of people, if you remember in the primary storage area, that would run a test against an all-flash system, and they wouldn't saturate the entire drives and push the drives into doing garbage collection. So you'd never see that cliff edge where you drop off at the end. It's that classic thing of not really thinking through what the POC needs to test.
Yeah, I think if I was being cynical, though, I think some vendors won't necessarily encourage you to do that. They'll want the POC to be kept as short as possible because they know if you keep it for a certain number of months, that you may not see the performance you saw initially. So, yeah, but the time constraints often on POC aren't just driven by the customer, also the vendor who may want to prevent you from hitting some of those cliff edge scenarios.
Absolutely. Within the product then, Aaron, in the InfiniGuard platform, how are you dealing with that and very randomness factor of the fact that a backup could be incremental over a number of different days and weeks and months rather than it being full backups that are continually taken? I can sort of see if you backed up an environment as a full backup, bringing it back would be relatively easy. But the randomness of incremental backups that might last for weeks and months seems a lot more complex.
So there are differences between backup streams that came in together, and you can use temporal location to place them close together, and you can combine that with a lot of predictive caching to try and provide that throughput from DRAM, which is what we try to do with our primary storage and our secondary storage always. We try to pre-populate things into DRAM predictively to help customers get higher throughput. And then there are times where you kind of make a huge seek across the install base where you have to understand, for example, that this was yesterday's backup and this was the backup from last week, and you're moving between them. And that is a harder thing to do and requires a lot more understanding of your own data layout to be able to quickly jump between them. However, there's a whole part in our architecture that spreads the data evenly across all the drives. So you kind of keep the system evenly balanced at all points. And then you have the benefit of getting more data from more drives concurrently and then kind of drive the throughput using concurrency and not just the data layout component. But if I'm looking at a holistic approach to that, at the end of the day, the easiest way to recover is to not have to move data at all. That's our snapshot discussion. But when you talk to customers and you ask them, why don't you keep too many snapshots? It's usually, well, when we're paying for an all-flash array, the cost of the snapshot ends up being a lot if we keep them for more than a week or 2 weeks. And that goes back to what we always say about instead of providing performance using all-flash, which is kind of throwing the expensive media at the problem and just saying, just put more hardware in it, like putting a bigger engine in a car. We do the same thing with innovation, with software essentially and architecture. And then our customers usually keep a longer snapshot retention time, leading to a lot more recovery scenarios that happen from snapshots. So there are multiple secondary, tertiary effects here by choosing a different technology that enables you better protection.
So how about the combination of snapshots, replication, InfiniGuard? Can I use, for example, snapshots and replication together? Because of, you know, traditional environments, you know, you see taking snapshots of clones off the remote box is seen as potentially a safe way of securing a copy of data, as long as you can actually get that back to the primary side. You know, can you do that sort of scenario with snapshots?
Yes. And in fact, when we started developing our replication engine back 6-7 years ago, one of the key requirements we had was that there won't be a synthetic separation between replication for disaster recovery purposes and replication for archival backup recovery kind of purposes. And the use of snapshots actually allows you to be very efficient that way. So for example, maybe you decide to archive all of your snapshots offsite because you also want them to be not just an accessible copy, but also accessible if your main site is now down. So for example, some customers might keep a month worth of snapshots on their production environment and 6 months worth of snapshot on their secondary system. But if they need to recover from a snapshot that is not within the production retention time, it is still only an incremental copy back from the DR side. So yeah, we do see customers relying more and more on snapshots. And one of the benefits is that you can actually see ransomware causing inflation of your snapshots. Because what does ransomware do? It will encrypt your data, which will reduce your data reduction rates, and it will create higher changes of writes, of changes. So your bottom line is snapshot will inflate. And if you keep a long enough snapshot retention, you can very easily identify ransomware. And in fact, we have an ongoing research project to use our cloud AI ops to actively announce to our customers, hey, that data set seems suspicious because compression is going down, data change is increasing. You might want to look at that as a ransomware candidate.
I think that angle of using that sort of data on shared storage is a really positive approach. The reason I say that is I look at that and I compare it to the way that we always talked about software-defined storage and how it was going to take over because people would buy commodity and then they'd put the software on top and away we go. But those solutions never get the benefit of that shared knowledge and knowledge from that platform that gets put into online services that can do that level of analysis. And with enough data, absolutely you can come up with some really interesting pieces. And the snapshot one for ransomware has to be one of the really interesting ones.
I agree. And we think that consolidating more and more data sets in one single pane of glass could be a key factor in identifying ransomware.
Yeah, I've always wondered why we've not seen this happen earlier, because one of the things with snapshots is it's a really good idea, a good way of identifying where you've got rapid rate of change in an environment. And if you're not used to seeing that, you should be asking why. We do it on times. We have looked at snapshots where we've seen things grow very, very quickly. Sometimes it's because somebody's done something stupid, like deleted a load of files, which they shouldn't have done. So the snapshots picked it up as a change. But it just seems really obvious.
I think I do agree with you. And I would say that when I was doing physical backup management on physical servers, which is a long time ago, don't say how long ago, but we would look at rate of change of backup. And we would look at rate of change in general across the entire infrastructure to try and get an idea. So we were already looking at that just simply in terms of capacity management. So it seemed like a logical extension to look at the snapshots. But I think the difference now is you have so much more data to use because you can keep that data for a long, long time. But also you can share knowledge from other platforms. So you, for example, and I don't know whether you do this, Aaron, but you could, for example, if you see many, many boxes in a large environment suddenly starting to see ransomware. So let's say a customer's got 5 or 10 boxes. You could actually proactively start doing something on the boxes that haven't seen that yet to make sure that you're starting to protect the snapshots. Now, I don't know if that's something you do, Aaron, but it seems to me that you've got that sort of capability.
So you raise an interesting point. And so, yeah, we do see interesting results as we coalesce data from multiple data sources. However, I don't know of any customer that will allow their vendor to remotely do things on their system without going through them. So what we're actively researching now is, can we identify the trend, proactively push an alert to the customer that says, hey, something looks suspicious. That data set is experiencing these ransomware-like behaviors. Go and check it out. By the way, we highly recommend you start taking snapshots on that data set so that later you can go back and recover at least some of these. And if you already have snapshots of the data set, please do not delete them because you may need them in an hour to recover your data.
But you could lock that, couldn't you, for the customer in advance and say, we've proactively locked. I mean, you could give the customer the choice, of course, but you could say, we'll proactively lock them. And if you've got customers who are keeping 6 months worth of snapshots, it's not going to be an imposition to keep an extra few hours worth in order for them to go and do that investigation. And if it's triggered on their request, then they've got that configured so that when that happens, it's triggered. You know, it wouldn't be an imposition or a cost for them. So,
It's not the cost. It's their security people that have to sign off on something having inside access from the outside world. Just like we discussed offline about the example of the Texas attack that was trying to attack the MSP to have a wider impact. If I'm a security person, I don't know how well that vendor's infrastructure is protected. So I'm not that excited about letting them access from the outside through my firewall into my critical infrastructure. And even getting read-only access, so having all of the data sent to the cloud and analyzed, is sometimes challenging, which is why I doubt we'll see what you're talking about. But because the data gets analyzed in real time, we can reach out, and we very often reach out to customers, whether it's email, phone, or depending on the level of urgency and time of day, to let them know, hey, something's happening, let's work together. And that's part of a whole proactive support model or support extension of the AI ops component, whatever you want to call that.
What I would say is, as we're seeing more gathering of metrics and telemetry on arrays which are going back to vendors, vendors should be able to pick this up and actually almost be able to produce a weather report across their whole estate and say, you know what, we've been seeing these attacks or we've seen something going on. So if you suddenly saw this attack going across, say, a customer's, all of a customer's array or a bunch of customers, you can actually use this as a weather report to say, we're seeing something, please check or reach out to your security vendors.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. And there'd have to be some very good anonymity within that. You wouldn't want to in any way expose any customer confidences, but I agree. You know, there's many ways you could cut it, but, you know, Aaron, you've got the data. It's just what you can persuade customers to let you do.
Yeah, agreed.
So it sounds like we're talking about having multiple different approaches here. You know, it might be snapshots on your primary data. It might be snapshots with replication, so you can get those into another box in another location. And then we're talking about InfiniGuard plus the ability to put this data into a dashboard that you can then look at. It sounds to me like you really do need to have, I wouldn't say holistic, but you need to have a comprehensive approach, Aaron.
The only tool I would consider adding to the comprehensive list you just gave is immutable snapshots, the ability to prevent snapshots from being mutilated or in any way manipulated by any ransomware or malicious code. And I think those together create the beginning of a very good protection strategy.
Great. Okay, so if we've interested people in finding out a bit more, other than infiniGuard.com, where would you push them to? What's the best website for them to go to, and where can they find more information?
So InfiniGuard is very well documented on infiniGuard.com. You can reach out to me, Aaron Brown. I'm mostly on LinkedIn. I admit that I don't like the other platforms as much. And we're doing more and more around the recovery side of things. You can find a white paper we recently wrote about a holistic approach to protecting from ransomware on our website if you want to follow up on that reading.
Okay, brilliant. I'll put all of those items in the show notes. I think, you know, it's been an interesting discussion. I know we've talked about product, but there's some bits and pieces here that we've picked up on, I think, that are going to be really interesting for people to think about, especially around the POC side of things and how long you've run that for and so on. So, you know, thanks for the conversation. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, Martin. And look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thank you both very much.
Cheers, Chris.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.